Okay, this is a meeting of the staff of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission with Don Bassinius of Freddie Mac. And first of all, Don, we would like to tape record if that's all right with you.
Yes.
So why don't we do go around and say who we are for the people who will be transcribing.
Sure. I'm Jason Frank with Bingham McCutcheon for Freddie Mac.
I'm Alexis Semendinger with the FCIC writing team.
Tom Stanton, FCIC.
Lisa McVitie from Freddie Mac. Catherine Murphy, Bingham McCutcheon.
Don Bassinius, Freddie Mac.
Great. Ron?
Ron Borzakowski, FCIC.
Great. Thank you very much for the meeting today. We usually start by asking your personal background, sort of from education forward to now.
Okay. Where do you want to start education? College?
Go wherever you are happiest.
I graduated from Creighton University with a bachelor's in economics and business communications. I have a PhD in economics from Iowa State University.
And when was that?
1985 was the PhD. And you want
just keep going
career history?
Yeah.
I started at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, and I'll be close on the years here, but may not be exact. From 85 till I think around 87.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for a company called Community Capital during 87. I went back to the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and was there until it was abolished. I think that'd be 1989. I was at the Federal Housing Finance Board after that until 1991, the end of 91, and then joined Freddie Mac in January of 1992.
And what are your positions that you held at Freddie, please?
I joined as the Director of Portfolio Quality. I was named Vice President of Mortgage Credit Policy, I believe it was 1996. All of the dates I give will be plus or minus a year.
Okay.
1996, I was promoted to the Senior Vice President of Risk Assessment in 1998. I was in that role, various titles, for the next decade. And in 2008, I was named the Senior Vice President of the Single Family Credit Guarantee Business. And in 2009, I was promoted to Executive Vice President of the Single Family Credit Guarantee Business.
Great. Given your perspective, why don't we start with your perception of the financial crisis and the housing aspects of the financial crisis as they developed. In other words, what in your view, what are some of the causes and developments that led to the financial crisis?
So I guess the simplest way to think about it is, a significant run-up in house prices.
Excuse me.
That led to a collapse.
What about on the mortgage side?
You're a little bit more specific on the mortgage side.
I guess as when you were at the Home Loan Bank Board, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage was the classic,
mm-hmm.
and we had a lot of developments since then.
Mm-hmm.
And did that have anything to do with the crisis?
I think it's possible.
In what sense? I'm just tapping your wisdom as an economist who is in a senior housing position over that period to get your sense of.
Yeah, the reason I say I think it's possible is the evolution of products outside the fixed rate 30 product that you mentioned. Probably enabled homeowners to purchase more housing than they might have otherwise been able to purchase with a fixed rate 30 mortgage, which would then allow them to bid up the prices.
And what was Freddie Mac's policy on qualifying homeowners for their houses? In other words, would you underwrite them to a 30-year fixed rate level, or would you underwrite them to whatever the terms were of the kind of mortgage they had?
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that, only because I think, one, policies evolve over time, okay, and two, policies were probably different for different products. So.
Just run us forward if you can. I mean, you can run us through a variety of subprime, Alt-A, whatever it was that Freddie, in fact, was purchasing. I'm trying to understand underwriting standards by the GSEs, and Freddie Mac in particular, that were in fact different from underwriting standards and what the popular press calls the shadow banking system, the vertical integration that took place from originators, subprime originators, back through private label securities. The Freddie Mac standards were different from that. I could even hazard a guess they were better than that. And I'm curious, sort of your perception as a senior official at Freddie with an economics PhD, what was Freddie shooting for in terms of underwriting standards over time? And take us forward, that's fine.
Yeah, I want to make sure I understand when you talk about underwriting standards. If you can help give just a little bit of description, when you use that phrase, what you mean by it, I think I can be more responsive to the question.
If I apply for a mortgage, Loan Prospector gives me an accept or a refer, at least they used to, maybe not something else. And there have to be parameters in that box that somehow deal with my capacity to repay the mortgage. So I'm curious if you take an arm, mm-hmm, of various sorts, mm-hmm, and over time they might be special kinds of arms, mm-hmm, 228s, 327s, a reduced documentation loan, name your product, a subprime loan, mm-hmm, where the FICO might be someplace but you have a higher LTV, you have other characteristics. I'm curious how Freddie viewed the market as it evolved, say, from 2000 forward, mm-hmm, and sort of where you tried to keep your underwriting standards vis-a-vis that market.
Yes, let me try a couple of dimensions on that one, see if this helps. And you mentioned a number of components, Loan Prospector and things like that. I think the way to think about it is, from a pure credit policy perspective that you describe, I think it's fair to say that generally borrowers were being underwritten at the kind of full rate. Again, the vast majority of product Freddie Mac buys is fixed rate 30, fixed rate 15. So the underwriting standards there are straightforward. It is, what's the mortgage payment? And then there's a relationship between that mortgage payment along with other payments and the borrower's income. I assume that's what you're looking at, mm-hmm, when you think about capacity.
Mm-hmm.
For adjustable rate products, depending on the term of the product, those loans were either qualified at fully indexed rates or kind of first-year rates, and again, it all depended on kind of the length of the product. I don't recall the specific rules for each one, but it depended on the kind of the term of the adjustable rate.
So say you had a 228. Would you underwrite it at the 2 or at something else?
Within the single-family guarantee business, which is one I'm familiar with, we weren't buying 228s.
Or 327.
Yeah, we weren't buying those products as part of our guarantee business.
Or Neg Am?
We bought some negative amortization product. Yeah, we bought some negative amortization product. And there I don't recall what the underwriting capacity rules were.
Okay. Let me go to the end and then pick it up in the beginning. Why did Freddie Mac fail?
I guess my simple answer is I'm not sure we did.
Okay.
Sorry.
Why did Freddie Mac not succeed?
I think there was a perception that the losses that Freddie Mac would experience would either exceed its capital or that there'd be a loss of confidence in Freddie Mac, and so decisions were made to put us in conservatorship.
Did the losses have anything to do with the kind of products Freddie was buying?
Yes.
In what way? Can you be more explicit?
Yeah, I mean, by definition, given our business, losses come from the products that we buy. So I'm trying to be cute there, but so yes, our losses were directly correlated with
the process. Let's start with it. I mean, I was worried we'd have to go to paper. Let's start with the exceeding capital part. This is a Washington Post from March 13, 2008.
Thank you.
Okay. Chief says Freddie won't raise capital. Chief Financial Officer Anthony Pizzell made the point repeatedly for emphasis using the jargon of Wall Street. There's no dilutive capital raise planned. Were you aware of this decision?
Let me say this decision, that there's no dilutive capital raise planned? Yes.
Do you think it was a wise decision?
Yes.
Why?
Because I don't think it makes sense to do a dilutive capital raise.
In March of 2008? Given what you described as the problem Freddie Mac had by September of 2008, which was that their losses exceeded their capital?
No, actually, I said that there were those who thought expected our losses to exceed our capital.
Okay.
Right.
Given the perception that Freddie Mac's losses would exceed its capital.
Right.
So you agreed with this decision?
I agreed with the decision that no dilutive capital raise was planned. I agree with that.
Do you agree with the decision it shouldn't have been planned? There should not have been a dilutive capital raise?
Given the facts that were known at the time, yes.
Okay.
Can I ask you, were you invited to offer your advice before the decision was reached?
I don't recall being asked for my opinion on it.
Hey, let's go to the question of losses. This is Freddie's annual report from 2007.
Thank you.
There's a highlighted paragraph. The proportion of higher-risk mortgage loans that were originated in the market during the last 4 years increased significantly. We've increased our securitization volume of non-traditional mortgage products, such as interest-only loans and loans originated with less documentation in the last 2 years in response to the prevalence of these products within the origination market. Total non-traditional mortgage products, including those designated as Alt-A and interest-only loans, made up approximately 30% and 24% of our single-family mortgage purchase volume in the years ended December 31, 2007 and 2006, respectively. Our increased purchases of these mortgages and issuances of guarantees on them expose us to greater credit risk. I'd like to understand, from your perspective as head of single-family, which I think you were at that point, 2008, I guess you were still on the risk side in 2007, is that correct?
Actually, during 2007, I was working on special projects for the firm.
Okay. I'm interested in your thought that the company in the last 2 years, including Alt-A and interest-only loans, purchased 30% of its mortgages in these non-traditional products, 24% in 2007 and 24% in 2006. What's the nature of decisions that led to that change in composition of mortgages that then, going to your formulation, would have led to people perceiving that Freddie Mac's losses were going to exceed its capital?
So, excuse me, what's the nature of decisions?
How did Freddie Mac make the decision to go into non-traditional mortgages so substantially?
I don't recall there being a specific decision point.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how to answer the question.
Did you concur in 06 and 07 with the idea that Freddie Mac would liberalize its underwriting standards to make this kind of purchase?
One, I don't believe I was in a position in 2007 to have a formal opinion on. As I said, I was working on special projects.
Did you
have
an informal opinion?
To your earlier point, at least if I understood the question correctly, you were operating the impression that we changed those standards in 2006-2007. I don't recall that being the case.
I'm just reading the language here, and that seems to be what it says.
No, actually, what I think it says is that that's what we purchased. The underwriting standards may have been supportive of these products before that. There simply wasn't the product available in the marketplace. I don't think these facts by themselves indicate that policies changed in this time period.
As EVP for single family today, have you had occasion to ask whether underwriting standards did change in that period?
Not that I recall.
So you weren't interested in the question of whether the losses people perceived Freddie Mac would take arose in some way from changed underwriting standards?
I'd answer just slightly different than what you just created, which is that I and we have looked extensively at what were the products that are contributing to the losses.
Yeah.
That's different than asking the question of what our underwriting policies are. The way you ask the question, it's
well,
like
then
I'm not
frame
interested.
It, was it wise to buy so many all-day and interest-only loans? Let me start with the easy part of it. Why? I don't understand why this is so difficult. We're trying to understand the financial crisis. The facts are on the table. I don't understand why this conversation is not more fluid, I will tell you.
I just think that there might be some confusion about this issue of whether underwriting standards changed.
But there's a way to answer the right question if I asked it inarticulately.
I don't think no one's criticizing the question. I think he's hearing questions about changed underwriting standards, and I don't think that he's testified that there were changed underwriting standards.
Do you think there were changes in underwriting standards? From, say, 2004 onward?
Yes.
Can you describe those changes?
I can probably describe some of them. I don't know if I'm aware of all of them. Again, best of my recollection, the types of products... the reason I'm pausing on this one is 2004 isn't like a demarcation line, so I'm trying to be responsive to the question, but at the same time, make sure that it's full.
Take it forward to where you want to answer it.
I'd actually go back in time, not forward.
Okay,
so
go back.
Which would be kind of the decision to expand the types of products that Freddie Mac would purchase actually went back to 1997.
That's when Freddie decided to buy Alt-A and interest-only loans?
It is when Freddie Mac decided to expand its product offering, including Alt-A.
And did anything significant change with respect to Alt-A, and that's a big category, going forward from 1997?
Well, two things, and just to highlight the point you just made, is that Alt-A is a label that, as we many times said in our disclosures, is a hard thing to define because it means something different to everyone. So if I were to describe it consistent with how we disclose around it, I think the underwriting practices that were included in Alt-A did evolve over that time period from 1997, say, to the 2008 time.
And how did they evolve?
The amount of reduced documentation associated with them increased.
What was significant about 97?
Freddie Mac engaged in a strategic planning effort in the 1996-97 time period, and as part of that strategic planning effort, decided to expand the types of products that we purchased.
I noticed on your bio that I got from the website, from 1997 until 2008, you were senior vice president for credit policy and portfolio management.
So you took over that job in 97. Were you helpful to contribute to that strategic plan?
Yes.
Okay. So how much influence did you have on the demarcation of change in thinking?
On that particular strategic effort, it's actually just prior to being promoted, the beginning work before I was promoted, I was the staff person supporting the analysis around that. Mm-hmm. So the decision makers on that particular strategic effort would have been the senior management committee at the time.
But that wasn't when I asked you, I said, how much did you contribute to it? So I wasn't asking what titles they had, just you know, what value added you gave it.
Again, I provided the staff work support on the opportunity in that market.
Okay.
Did you generally attend board meetings?
No.
Did you attend board meetings when strategic decisions were being made? Say in the after 1997.
I don't recall attending them throughout much of the early parts of the 2000s. I was part of them probably in the mid-2000s.
Forward.
So the decision to expand, just describe how that was, you know, why was that considered a good move to make?
In 1997? When we looked at the marketplace and the business that Freddie Mac was doing, we thought we could actually serve our mission better by expanding out on the types of products we'd offer.
Okay. In relationship to the climate at that time, competition.
Yeah, I mean, all
of those things together.
The environment was all considered in the analysis.
Okay. And would you say that decision was maintained all the way through? Was it reevaluated every year? Or?
I think it was reevaluated, but it would be too strong. I think it was reaffirmed pretty much annually, as best as I think about it.
Was there a regular time of year when it would be reaffirmed?
Probably kind of annual planning cycles would be when I think you would.
And what can you give a sense of that cycle? Just the calendar, the kind of dates, when you would, so your senior team would gather to consider strategic issues, when it would go to the board.
Yeah, generally, I think it varied year to year, but generally in the fall, business areas would put together their plans. It would be collated and would usually probably go to a December board meeting.
Okay. Here's a document that I'm sure you've seen many times from the Government Oversight Committee. Having to do with Freddie Mac's decision to purchase no income, no asset mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
You are listed as someone who was concerned about that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe the discussions that took place over no income, no asset mortgages?
I think there were a lot of discussions that were occurring as we've seen this document before. This was in part motivated by a discussion of reevaluating our expansion into those products. So given my role within the firm, I began to question whether it was the right place for us to be and wanted a reaffirmation by senior management that this was the type of offering we wanted to have.
And then,
And again, it goes back a little bit in time. Best I can recall, it was when I was looking at the types of loans that were defaulting in our quality control space and just the type of business that was producing. It made me wonder whether it was the right type of business.
Because of the risk? Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah, I don't know that I was as concerned about the risk per se. And here, when I say risk, it would have been kind of default probability. It was more whether the product kind of was serving the marketplace in a positive way. I think, as I say here, it's more of a reputation issue than it was a risk issue.
Okay. What kind of reaction did you get when you were offering your expert what they paid you for perspective?
I would call the perspective being, you know, listened to and considered.
And final decision?
The decision was made that we would continue to acquire these products.
In retrospect, was that a good decision?
I think it's hard to try to second guess. You know, in hindsight, knowing what I know today, these products clearly are causing losses for us. I don't know what the consequence would have been had we not chosen to participate in this market.
So nobody's run a quantitative kind of analysis at Freddie Mac to try to figure out answers to questions like that? Sort of how many losses did we take from what kind of product, and what does it mean for our business going forward?
No, we have done that. What I was describing was you don't know how the marketplace and we would have played out from the decision you didn't make as opposed to the decision you did make.
Are there lessons learned? I mean, did you write a lessons learned document, or have you seen one that would look back at this kind of a decision and or this kind of product and ask the question, what was the impact on Freddie Mac's bottom line?
I don't know if there was a specific lessons learned as you described it. We changed our policies and are purchasing these products now, but
assume that I've been once again inartful in my question.
Okay.
And that there's something that might look like a lessons learned document but isn't.
Right.
What would you call it?
You mean assuming something like that exists?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if it has a name. I don't know that there's a lessons learned or lessons learned type document. You'd ask the question, have we evaluated the impact of these types of products on us? The answer is sure.
Okay, given the amount of paperwork that was generated around shall we continue in no income, no asset loans,
right,
is it a reasonable assumption that there has to be some paper someplace around the question of what have we learned from having dealt so actively in no income, no asset loans and from having dealt so actively in other kinds of Alt-A?
First, actually, I wouldn't characterize as having participated actively in no income, no asset loans. I think that was always a relatively small part of our purchases.
That may be. That's why one wants to learn. These numbers are fairly large, and what I'm trying to understand in order to understand the financial crisis and what happened at Freddie Mac is what kind of loans were in that bucket called Alt-A, and what lessons has Freddie Mac studied from that experience that might help us at the commission to understand going forward what was going on in the mortgage market and what we learned about it.
Right. So as I said, we've done analysis to say what are the sources of our losses.
Okay.
I mean, that analysis has been done. In fact, I think it's in our disclosures where we talk about what are the key drivers of our losses.
Mm-hmm.
We have made policy changes that now restricts our willingness to purchase these types of assets. So those would be the two things that have been done kind of in response.
So in between, this isn't playing gotcha, we're just trying to ask.
Okay.
So let's say there's a meeting and everybody talks about how things are going, and you said in the fall you usually meet, and decisions get made, the board makes decisions, whatever. Is there a way that then that is communicated to then become the operational formula for the business?
I don't think it's quite that. I guess I don't think it comes through that clear, that specific.
Okay.
Plus, I think the organization and the operation of the organization changes dramatically in a post-conservatorship world as opposed to a pre-conservatorship world. So kind of some of the normal processes would not have existed.
Okay.
But the way, if I understand your question correctly, the way those views get communicated is they are discussed among the board, they then get discussed among the management committee, and then get affected either through corporate policy or policy changes.
Okay, and so when they reach a decision together, it would be committed to minutes, or that's the record?
I mean, there's minutes of board meetings.
Okay. So the minutes would then reflect that there's been an appraisal, then there's been new instruction, and so that would help guide you as staff, right? How do you learn what the board has decided? This isn't so hard. Your wife says take out the garbage. She tells it to you to your face. If she leaves you a note in the morning, you have a note. So how did you learn this?
I think it's actually more complicated than you're suggesting.
Everything about this last 45 minutes has been more complicated, so make it easy.
To the extent we seek specific guidance from the board, business plans, budgets, things like that, there is an affirmative decision made. To the extent we are seeking general guidance from the board on the course and direction, mm-hmm. then that general guidance is communicated by either the CEO or the COO to the management committee.
How?
And we build orally.
Okay, orally. Okay.
And we then build that into our operating plans and our decision-making processes.
Okay. And then how does that become part of the record, though? In other words, so that everyone's clear what the oral instructions were. Is that, then do you commit that to some sort of note yourself to the files, or?
I might, or the way it gets communicated, so if there's a change in direction, a change in policy, then the people who write policies, the chief credit officer like that, frame a policy and distribute it. And in the business areas, then, to the extent that policy needs to be implemented in the marketplace, develop operational procedures to execute it into the marketplace. So it manifests itself in corporate policy, I guess is the right way to describe it.
So if we asked for a memoranda from the credit officer, 07, which is the date of this annual report, mm-hmm. and 08, we might get Freddie Mac's perception of lessons learned, saying, let's stop buying no income, no asset loans, let's start requiring more documentation, and maybe even an explanation.
I think it's possible.
You've never seen anything like that coming out of the credit office.
I haven't seen a credit memorandum. I've seen policy changes. Right, so they draft a new policy.
Yeah.
I will see that policy when it's drafted.
What's it called?
A credit policy.
So there will be a document labeled credit policy.
Right. We have a corporate credit policy within the firm that is the collection of all the credit policies that guide the business and the acquisition of risk.
Great. And I take it that's something that's updated regularly.
Yes.
Okay, so we can ask for that as of 2007, and we can probably get more granularity than we can get out of the public disclosure. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, it'll be more granular than that.
You used to be the chief credit officer, right?
I never officially had that designation.
But you had that job.
I managed the credit for the single family business.
So why is this one so hard to understand?
Why is what one so hard?
Why is it so hard to have this conversation to understand what will be issued from the credit office and what's in it and where we find the document?
We're just trying to look at an evolution of
We're trying to understand.
That's it.
So in part it's hard because I don't have that role. And so I don't want to speak for the folks in that role and describe something that I'm not 100% sure is accurate.
We're not here to indict you. We are here to try to understand causes of the financial crisis. This is not supposed to be as adversarial as you may have been counseled.
Tom, I think that the mere fact that there can be misunderstandings in question and answer doesn't necessarily mean anything's adversarial, and it doesn't necessarily mean that he was counseled in any particular way. I'm sorry this isn't going as smoothly as you'd like, but we'll try to get you the answers to your questions.
That would be good. I've got to tell you that we've interviewed other financial institutions, and I think the conversations we've had with Freddie people have been among the most difficult, which is what leads me to think that it is a matter of counseling rather than a matter of individual proclivities. We're trying to understand history here. We're not trying to allege some sort of serious misdeeds.
I think we understand, Tom, and I'm sorry that it hasn't been as smooth as you want, but I know Mr. Vicenis is trying to answer your questions, so.
Okay, good. I appreciate that. We will keep going. Why was David Andrikonis fired?
I don't know.
Nobody ever told you?
No. I don't know that he was fired, but I know he left the firm.
And did you ever have occasion to ask someone at Freddie Mac why Dave Andrikonis might have been fired? might have left the firm? Let me rephrase it.
I don't recall actually asking anybody that question.
So you have no surmise as to why Dave Andracona's left the firm?
I have, based on my conversations with Dave,
yeah,
I have an understanding why he left the firm.
And what is that understanding?
That he wanted to pursue teaching.
Okay. What does VRJ stand for in a memorandum heading? This says SISA as VRJ. Let me give you the full memo. Actually, let me give you April 5 first.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know what VRJ is.
Why would someone send you an email with something in the heading that you wouldn't know what it is?
I can't answer that. I could surmise potentially it is a typo. It should have been VIU as opposed to VRJ.
That's
in
the one below. And what does VIU stand for?
It was characterized as view, which was visible, high impact, or unusual.
Okay, and we have an email from you as part of this chain, and I'll just represent to you, even though it's in Word format, that it is taken directly from a document. Second page, April 4th, 2004. And if you flip to the third page, you write, "While I continue to share Shelley's reservations regarding the risk aspects of the SISA program, I feel that the issue has already been discussed and decided. As such, I see no additional benefit from raising the issue one more time as a VRJ issue," which means you committed the typo.
Actually, I think what may have happened here is the thing I see it quite a few spots is it may have been a global substitute.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know.
You think it's VIU?
I think it's VIU.
Okay. Good. Thank you. So basically, am I right in understanding what you write here, that I have concern about risk, and remember, this is different from what we heard, which was appropriateness for the market. What this says is I have concerns about risk, so it is a little different from your answer to Alexis' question. But the decision was made, and we should go along with it. Is that roughly what this means?
Yeah, I two things I'd say in this one, Tom. One would be is, you know, as I say here, I continue to have reservations regarding risk aspects. And for me, as I recall on this one, the risk aspects here is, can we understand and price that risk? That's different from pure reputational. This was actually talking about CISAs as opposed to NINAs, two mm-hmm. different products.
Right.
The earlier one where I talked about the reputation issue really did focus on the NINA loan, the no income, no asset loan. In this particular case, it is around CISAs, the stated income, stated asset programs. I had then and have had continuously questions about kind of whether we can understand and price this risk as well as other types of risks. What I did say in here is that I think that question was raised, the VIU, answered, and therefore we move forward.
Who's Donna Cogswell?
I believe at this time she was Dave Andraconis' assistant.
Is she still at the firm?
Yes.
Thank you. Her recommendation was Freddie should withdraw from the NINA market as soon as practical.
I'm sorry, whose was?
Cogswell.
I don't believe it'll be Donna Cogswell, given that Donna's an administrative assistant.
Where is that?
Oh, sorry. Let me give you the next one. Let's see. That's 26.
Here. Thank you.
On 2, 4, 5. Middle of the page. Maybe it's signed at the end with somebody else's name. I don't see it signed.
I'm sorry, are the pages numbered?
No, unfortunately.
I see your highlight there from Donna.
I'm
6, okay.
Yeah, I don't know this with fact. My guess is this is Dave Andracona speaking, and Don is forwarding
the
message.
Do you see any linkage between the kind of decisions that were made about NINA and CISA loans and what appeared in the Freddie Mac 2007 annual report that says we've taken substantial losses on non-traditional products?
And again, not trying to be difficult, you say, do you see any connection? I'm not sure what you mean.
I mean, does one thing have anything to do with the other thing?
I think the answer is no.
So there's no connection. These are Alte products, right?
I think generally they'd be categorized as Alte. That's right.
And they were part of the losses that are being talked about in the 2007 report. Why would there not be any connection then, just so I can understand your thinking?
Well, one, the decisions that are being made are separated by at least 3 years, if not more, in time. That's why I wasn't drawing a direct connection between them.
So they got better? They got less risky over time?
No, I don't think so. I'm trying to separate out a decision made in 2004 and not say, well, look, 3 years later, 4 years later, that decision created this outcome. I don't know that that's the case. The particular losses we're talking about there, as we say, I think either in that one or in other disclosures, largely came from the 06 book, to some extent the 07 book, which are different books than what are being created in 2004. That's why I'm trying to separate the two.
You mentioned that you did attend meetings of the board. I only have one of these because I didn't want to kill a tree. If you look at the back, actually, can I trade you? Mine has the earmarks on it.
Sure.
Thank you. If you look at the back where the...
Can we just read the title into the record?
Yeah, sorry. Yes, absolutely. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Freddie Mac's Business Strategy Board of Directors meeting, March 2007. That's a meeting you would have attended if we understood you correctly.
I believe I was at this meeting, yes. At least for this portion.
And the title of the document is Freddie Mac's Business Strategy. Mm-hmm. And if we turn to page 73, the header is Potential Economics of Non-Prime Are Attractive. Did you concur with that formulation?
I think so. I don't call specific, but I think so.
Next page says non-prime could contribute significant earnings. Did you agree with that?
I believe I did.
Next page. Vision for Freddie Mac covering the whole conforming market. Broadened spectrum of loans we are willing to purchase. And the list here includes prime, alt-A, and subprime within the conforming space. Mm-hmm. Did you concur that this was a good vision?
Again, I think I concur that it was a reasonable approach.
It says here, our franchise, maximize shareholder returns by opportunistically varying our retained interests and leveraging market bids for other exposures. Did you agree with that?
So I don't think it's I don't think that's a simple yes-no answer.
Did you help create this document?
I believe I provided input into this document, yes.
Okay, so you've seen it?
Yes.
so then divide up the answer to my question any way you want.
Well, the reason I say that is, as you can well appreciate, any document, any strategic document, has lots of pages, lots of people providing input into it.
Okay.
Various statements, you know, I'm saying, yeah, that's reasonable.
Okay.
Is it necessarily the statement I would write, or is it necessarily, you know, this is the best thing we could do? Not, okay, not that's clear. That's all I'm trying to clarify.
Okay, that's great. Okay. Page 76, we need to close capability gaps. Mm-hmm. Page 77, our strategy of expanding into adjacent markets will advance our objectives. Question. Did the board adopt this strategy?
I believe so.
In March of 2007. And yet, by the end of that year, it was clear. How long would it take to implement this strategy? To begin to see pipeline come in after the board makes a decision like this?
Again, I think various parts of it were going to take longer than others. We began trying to develop a subprime offering shortly thereafter.
When would the first subprime pursuant to that new development have come into the pipeline?
I think we actually made some acquisitions under that, maybe as early as June or July of that year.
Okay. And what about the Alt-A piece of this?
Yeah, I don't recall there being anything unique about the Alt-A portion of this, kind of independent of what we already were doing.
Okay, so it really was more of a reach to subprime.
Yeah.
Now, it talks there, the one we just sort of went quickly because this is a fat document and I haven't read it, and I apologize. I think you've seen it in a previous conversation. We need to increase our capabilities. Mm-hmm. What happened at Freddie Mac between March and June or July to increase Freddie's capabilities to manage the added risk?
I don't recall anything specifically happening on that. What we did was designed the offering to be consistent with our existing capabilities.
Okay.
Right, so we had certain capabilities. Here, prior to this, we didn't view ourselves as purchasing subprime product.
Right.
We were going to design a product that we thought would serve this market, but would be able to be acquired within our existing capabilities.
Were you successful?
We designed an offering. We didn't buy much product under it.
So you began, but this strategy ultimately, let me try to phrase it right and correct my inartful phrasing, the strategy was largely left unimplemented.
Yes.
What does that mean?
That means that
you didn't buy a lot of product.
We didn't buy a lot of product under this strategy.
But I mean, compared to what was the comparison? I mean, from your framework, what's a lot?
Well, I'm trying to recall. We actually had some kind of targets around how much we would buy. I'll be ballpark on this one when we check the facts. Ultimately, I think from the subprime portion of this one, I don't think we bought more than $50 million. Freddie Mac's a $1.8 trillion book. We buy $300 billion a year, so $50 million in this space is a pretty small amount. There just wasn't much product that fit the terms, underwriting standards, parameters that we had created.
I need to put a couple things together.
Okay.
Freddie, retrospectively, took a serious hit on its 06 book as well as its 07 book.
Yes.
Home prices had peaked in mid-06. Why was the board considering in March of 07 to expand the amount of credit risk that the company would take?
I can describe at least why we were recommending it. I don't know exactly. I can't put myself on the board's head to know why they were doing
it. Yeah, good.
So I think there were a couple of things, right? The nature of the business we were in is one that takes on risk for a fee. And so we knew this was a particular space, like the document even called it, that some people were retreating from. We thought that actually offered an opportunity for us to fill that void and get paid for taking that risk.
So it was going to, basically, you were going to price against that risk?
Absolutely.
And did you think that Freddie Mac, given its status as a government-sponsored enterprise, could afford to price loans from low-income people significantly higher than loans to middle-income people?
We don't price based on the borrower's income.
I understand.
Dude, I think we could price this product to the borrower profile, credit profile, and others that are being served higher than we price loans with borrowers with better credit profiles and greater down payments? Absolutely.
Had anybody considered the reputational implications if it turned out that that product was going to lower income people compared to the traditional products for anybody?
I recall and believe that was actually considered, and the trade-off being is part of our mission is to serve that particular borrower base as well.
I don't think I've got any more questions. This has been interesting to put these things together. Ron, any questions?
I think I'm okay for right now.
I have one.
Okay.
At least. You were talking in the beginning about what happened to go into conservatorship.
Yeah.
So do you feel that that was the wrong decision? From where you sat?
Don't know for sure, obviously. Sure. You know, from my own vantage point, it seemed premature to me.
Premature or something that should not have happened?
I can only say premature because I don't know how the world would have played out otherwise. Right? So, yes. I mean, I look at the losses that we have booked, haven't even yet experienced, but provided for and things like that. And it's not clear that the timing and magnitude of those would have been sufficient to wipe out capital.
Right. Do you feel that, to some extent, there was a lack of clarity about the distinctions between Fannie and Freddie?
Make sure I understand the question. So, such that one firm should be treated different than the other firm?
During the period of time in which the decision was made to take both into consideration.
I don't have a good feel for that. I just don't know.
Did you ever experience a sense in any of the years that you've been there that there was a lumping of them together?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So during this period of time when things were moving fast and decisions were made in the Oval Office that this was going to happen over a weekend, do you personally have any sense that that happened again?
Yeah, I don't have a good. I really don't have a good sense for that. I don't
so
know.
So there was never discussion to that effect that you were, you know.
Not that I was part of or aware of.
But do you feel that you could have ridden it out?
I don't know. It's not out of the realm of possibility for me. I mean, one of the things I look at in this space is. $1.8 trillion portfolio, and yet it's got the best serious delinquency rate of anybody in the country. Right? Now, again, it's 4%. That's big. That's reflective of a market that's just tanked.
But that's why I asked the question about the March 2008 decision not to increase capital.
Yeah.
Freddie had significant leverage compared to other players in the market, including Fannie Mae, which went out with a $7 billion offering in 2008.
Yeah.
But that's precisely why I was trying to juxtapose the question of capital, which is the ability to withstand this kind of shock,
right,
including, incidentally, the perception of susceptibility.
So, Tom, I've got two thoughts around that one. Thought one would be, again, in hindsight, not clear it was the best move on the part of Fannie Mae to go out and raise $7 billion. I'm sure their investors aren't very happy. Part two is, no one at that point, I don't think, was predicting 20-25% declines in house prices. So when we were doing our analysis internally and asking ourselves, do we have sufficient capital? Because the only thing that would have made the capital raise dilutive is if you had plenty of capital and you bought and raised more, then you got to deploy it somewhere. if you actually fundamentally believe you have enough capital to withstand even a fairly significant downturn in house prices, you wouldn't raise capital. So when we raised those points, it was because we had evaluated our portfolio, we had done stress scenarios around it, not to the level we experienced, but again, I almost challenge anyone to say this was like high probability event. And we did not think that the losses we would experience in our portfolio, despite the types of products and things like that that we had, would be sufficient to wipe out the capital that we had.
What was your chief risk officer saying about that?
I don't recall Dave.
The Dave was gone by then.
Oh, in 2008?
Yeah.
I don't recall. I don't know whether was it Anurag at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't recall whether he was making a statement we had enough or not.
Does that mean if he was making a statement, it wasn't very loud?
Or maybe I wasn't listening. I don't know which.
Well, if somebody's deliberating something as significant as increasing capital in 2008 after the market has proven significant volatility, presumably one would consult the risk officer, and that would be part of a collective deliberation.
Yeah. I want to just challenge a little bit your statement about the market's gone through tremendous volatility. And even by the beginning of 2008, while house prices had stopped appreciating, they actually didn't begin declining until probably late 2007, maybe very early 2008. So they weren't appreciating at 20%, but during much of 2006 and even the first part of 2007, they were still positive appreciation, just not at the level we had seen prior. So I putting things into historical context are important. So the decision that's being made in March is being based on kind of late 2007 information, because it takes a lag to get the information. And at that point, I know we were not anticipating the level of house price decline that ultimately came about.
What were your models telling you in terms of built-in parameters, what you should anticipate?
Yeah, I don't recall how far we had stressed it. I mean, it's a noble fact. I just don't recall. But I don't know. We had put it through some stresses that were well outside of what we had experienced, again, anything prior of the Depression. And at that point, it looked as though there was enough capital to absorb the losses.
To what extent did Freddie Mac's affordable housing goals have any effect on what you purchased?
On what we purchased?
Yeah.
I mean, it clearly influences what we purchase. As you can see from this chart, which shows mission, or you know from the things we've done, right? Attaining or hitting our affordable housing goals is one of the important objectives for the firm.
And did that mean taking on additional risk?
Our experience has been, particularly the targeted programs for affordable lending, have higher risk attributes and therefore have higher probabilities of default, absolutely.
Excuse me for a second. What are the formal targeted programs within Freddie for these purposes?
The ones I'm referring to, well, the broad goals. Are you talking about the goals or the programs?
You referred to particular targeted programs that would help meet the goals.
Right. So the examples I'd give there probably would be, for us, the market name would have been Home Possible. We also purchased some of Fannie Mae's targeted program called My Community Mortgage. And it may have been some
from Fannie?
No, we purchased it from the marketplace, but it was originated to Fannie Mae's standards. And then there probably were some, you know, branded programs at major lenders that probably had some of the same risk attributes as Home Possible or My Community.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
I have one other question, and this is a question we've asked a lot of people, and they've had really interesting answers. So
it's a setup.
New England Patriots.
Yeah,
is the answer.
Exactly. I want to know, yes, look into the future. We've talked to so many people who lived through this incredible period of time and have had lots of reason to think back. Is there something that they learned afterwards, or that they wished, not necessarily that they should have done, but they wish they had done?
Yeah.
Either about something in their own realm of control, or that they had probed something else. I'm just curious, is there an answer to that when you sat up at night and thought, what could I have done?
Sure. I think the one place, maybe it's more than one, but the one place where I underestimated impact was, in some sense, the contagion effect. So I knew the type of product that we were buying. I knew kind of how that distributed out along the risk continuum and was actually relatively comfortable with the mix of really, really safe, i.e. low default probability business, and that that had higher default probability business. What I didn't fully factor in is how does those high probability market, high probability of default marketplace loans impact the loans in my portfolio, not just my higher probability default loans, but the entire spectrum. And so whereas loans on the continuum at the higher risk end of it, I think were a relatively small part of my $1.8 trillion portfolio, my portfolio still coexisted with loans that were backing private label securities and other market participant loans. And I could have had the safest portfolio defined as default risk, and it was still going to suffer huge losses because of what was going on around it. Mm-hmm. I underestimated how big, I call it a contagion effect, how big that contagion effect is.
And even if someone had sat you down and said, this is what, you know, this is what a contagion could be like, and you really had some sense of that, would you have been able to do something differently, seriously differently?
Sure. I think you always have choices.
Yeah.
Right. Again, I don't know how much it would have changed the ultimate outcome, if the ultimate outcome from my lens of being put in conservatorship, if ultimate outcome is it's the housing crisis, I don't know that it changes it. Right. Again, and that's part of when I made my comment before about a a relatively safe portfolio. Even if you carve out those loans, my portfolio is still going to take huge losses simply because of what's going on around it. And so could I have locally reduced the losses in my portfolio? To some extent. But not, I don't think nearly as much as everyone thinks.
In the world that you understood at the time, 06, 07, 08, were you pricing your non-traditional products appropriately for the risk?
Yeah, it's a good question. At the time we were putting them on, we thought so. Right. In fact, if I look at my entire portfolio, that was the one portion that I thought I was actually getting adequately compensated for the risk. I wasn't sure I was getting adequately compensated for the risk for the more traditional product. Mm-hmm. But we thought so at the time. Again, I didn't price for a 25% decline in house prices.
Did you have any, and as somebody involved in single family, did you look at the risk of different counterparties and how different counterparties might look in terms of what they were sending you, in terms of the G fees you were charging them, that kind of question?
Yes.
Did you find that some large counterparties were getting G fee pricing that was more favorable than the risk of those loans should have merited?
I describe it slightly different. I think it gets to the same point, but the way we look at it is when I looked at least our expected return on equity, so we assign a certain amount of capital to each loan, which then aggregates up to a counterparty, we clearly had a distribution of returns on equity that differed across counterparties.
Was Countrywide among the large lenders the one that gave you the more risky profile?
I don't recall whether they were, where they fell in that distribution of risk. Best of my recollection is we were getting a lower return on our Countrywide business. But as I said, that may well have been associated with safe business. That's why I want to be careful here. We actually thought we were earning lower returns on what people thought is to be more safe, the traditional types of products, than what we were earning on the more non-traditional products.
Sure, that caught the board's attention.
Sure, I think the strategic document highlights that. So it's not, you can't simply look at the return on equity and automatically assume that a lower return on equity implies that you were taking on riskier product. It may have been just...
Well, there are two factors I'm trying to get at, I guess. One of them, it's been described to me that some large lenders, if this is your credit box, were sending their stuff in just over the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue is pricing, that large counterparties, as I understood it, would get much better G fees than the smaller counterparties. And by large, I mean your top four, say.
Yeah.
First of all, is the second statement right, where your large counterpart is getting significantly better G fees than smaller?
Tom, I'd reword it only to the extent I'd say, did generally the large counterparties have better guarantee fees than the small ones? Yes. The significant, I'm not so sure. Again, we're also talking in the land of small numbers, right? If a guarantee fee on average at that time in particular was 12 to 15 basis points, it may have been that a larger counterparty would be at the 12 and the smaller might be at the 15. So is it significantly different? It's 3 basis points. It doesn't show up in mortgage rates. So is it different? Yes. I don't know that I'd use the adjective significantly different.
Was it your sense, let's go to the risk side, that Countrywide was sending its loans to you just above the...
I don't recall that, and that's something I would have been looking at. I think we got, at least from my vantage point, if it wasn't a pure representative mix of their production, it was kind of a normal distribution. I don't know whether it's skewed one way or the other a little bit, but it was. I don't recall ever looking at it and thinking, wow, everything's coming in right at the edge, which is what I heard you ask. Not even close to it.
Okay.
One last thing. To what extent do you think the FCIC should focus on the ratings agencies?
I actually have two answers for that. The short answer would be a lot.
Okay.
The longer answer would be, but within the context of the role they're asked to play within the marketplace.
Expand on that.
So it is on the one hand clear to me, this is just to me, that investors may have placed an over-reliance in ratings. I don't know that I hold the rating agencies accountable for that or the investor accountable for that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, rating agencies are simply outsourcing your own analytic work. You can either choose to hire a staff that can evaluate it yourself, or you may choose a business model which says I'm going to rely on an outsourced function, rating agencies. At the end of the day, it was my view, the role of the investor to make their own decision, which could include outsourcing, by the way, and then be accepting of the consequence of that decision. Having said that, it seems to me that particularly in the derivative space, the CDO space, the rating agencies just got it wrong.
Can I jump in with one quick question?
Yeah.
Following up on what you said earlier about the extent to which Freddie's book suffered losses as a result of a sort of broader climate, and you've referred to it as contagion, I'm curious which pathway of contagion you have in mind, which type of externality you focus on in thinking about that.
So the way I think about it is, imagine, again, four houses. I guess we should do 10, but four houses. I own the mortgage on one of them, and it's a fixed rate 30, prime loan, 80% loan to value, strong credit borrower. The other three homes in that market were financed by a couple in Alt-A, no doc, and one in subprime.
Mm-hmm.
Those loans default. House prices in that particular neighborhood are going to drop and drop precipitously. It is likely that my borrower will find themselves underwater, and therefore I will have a high risk of default, even though that was a perfectly fine loan. So when I describe contagion, what I failed to appreciate was kind of the risk exposure created by the growth of these non-traditional markets in the marketplace, completely independent of Freddie Mac. Right? From a Freddie Mac perspective, I looked at our overall mix on the continuum of risk and was actually comfortable that we had an okay distribution, even with some higher risk product. What I didn't appreciate was how the fact that that product had grown disproportionately in the marketplace and the effect that could have on even my what I perceived as lower risk loans.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, and largely that's relying on the fact that when those other three borrowers default and are put into distressed sales, be they short sales or foreclosure or something of the sort, the value of the property that you're now, this collateral for your loan has now fallen precipitously.
Right.
Do you have a sense of the extent to which, the prevalence of that other product in the market also drove prices up, that you were then lending against a, inflated or perhaps bubble or not tied to fundamentals, however you want to think about it, price when the loan was originated.
Yeah, no, that would have been kind of the second component is before you made that statement I was thinking about as well, and that is that that loan that I acquired, that 80% loan to value, good credit borrower, the value in that loan to value may have been fundamentally sound appraisal. There was nothing wrong. It looked at comps. But the three comps it looked at were on properties where the nature of financing allowed that borrower to bid up that price beyond what you might otherwise think, your words, the fundamentals may have supported. And so that's right, that I've got now a house that appropriately valued given the current market, but is being acquired at a time when markets in general are kind of speculative.
Very helpful, thank you.
If you could glance at page 53 of this report, and it basically is a simple chart that's headed, GSE presence has diminished with the rapid non-prime growth in recent years. And we've been given a different graph that shows sort of a fairly steep drop-off after 2003 in GSE market share, and then rising again, I guess, about 2006.
Yeah, mostly 7, but yeah.
So, yeah. And I'm curious, one of the drivers was probably the refi boom was over. That was 03. I'm curious the extent to which other factors played, including the amount of attention Fannie and Freddie were devoting to remediation.
Yeah. It's a little bit speculative on my part, but I'll offer two or three items here. I believe that the focus we needed to place on the restatement and the remediation took a tremendous amount of management's time and attention, and probably led to us being less aggressive or less competitive in the marketplace as we otherwise might have been. I do think a second item may have been, and you picked it up in the strategic document, that some of the innovations that were going on in the marketplace we simply couldn't support with our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so we were both maybe somewhat distracted with the remediation and didn't have the capability of buying it. And I think the third one would have been, as I mentioned, at least early on, some of the pricing in the space we thought was not appropriate and didn't want the risk.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think all three of those could have led to the inversion that you described.
And then sort of as it picks up, you said 07, which is when
right.
picked up fairly dramatically. What was changing at that point? You were coming out of remediation and what else?
We were well out of remediation, right? We, in some sense, were current in our financials at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Just gotten current. Two, market competition had actually begun to exit the marketplace, so you know, the aggressive bidding on the part of some of the dealer community and stuff, they were exiting out of that. That gave us the opportunity to then participate.
Yeah. Great. Thank you very much.
All right.
Somehow I had a sense we got more fluid as time went on. This is good.